Hi, my name's Ian McIntyre, and today I'll be presenting an interview with Ian Millis about the Victoria Street squats of the early 1970s. We'll be discussing how attempts by developer Frank Tiemann to demolish heritage buildings and destroy a unique community brought together a coalition of residents, squatters and the Builders Labourers Federation. In doing so, we'll also explore how this campaign catalysed resistance to political and police corruption and launched a new wave of squatting across New South Wales.
Don't need your millions, we don't need high-rise flats. All we want is the right to live, we want our old homes back. We fought you on the streets, from the roofs and chimney tops. We fought against your thugs and we fought against the cops.
What was Victoria Street like in the early 70s before the developers moved in?
Well, I mean, Victoria Street is one of those places where they occur everywhere and they move around, where basically it was the place for artists, you know, more in the 50s and 60s than in the 70s, but in the 70s it still had really large numbers of artists. On the edge of King's Cross, like all those places that had gone downhill from being other things, you know, but it was a really, because it was like very much in the inner city, and because it had had a really wide range of from everything from big mansions to little terrace houses to stables to whatever, it had this incredible range of types of buildings there. And so it was very flexible uses of every sort. And it had buildings of almost every era of Sydney architecture, dating from, you know, really early colonial stuff right through to stuff that had just been built in the last few years. You know, It was really wonderful example of social mix. It had artists, it had bohemians, you know, it had workers from down in who worked down at Garden Island, and it had for instance seamen and people like that, you know, like lots of transient people. There was always lots of transient people of one sort or another. It was just the classic example of flexible, adaptable architecture. You know, so you'd go into one building and here'd be these grand Georgian rooms, and you'd go into the other one and one next door and you're in a tin shed. You know, I mean, it had everything imaginable jammed into this fairly tight space. And basically over a short period of time, you know, just a couple of years, Frank Tiemann managed to buy up most of this whole strip from about halfway up the street right down to the end. And so suddenly you had this whole big long strip all bought up by one developer. And because it was basically on the edge of an escarpment that overlooked Woolloomooloo and the Central Business District and so on, it had great views, it overlooked the harbour. I mean, you see it was just ripe for that sort of stuff, you know, in one way, shape or form. And he's the one who managed to target it and pull it off. So.
Okay, so he started moving in, buying up from the early 70s. Yeah. And then in 73... April 73, he hired Fred Cray. And what happened to the existing tenants and the properties from that point
on? Basically, they just did a big sweep through and started forcing everybody out. You know, they could, you know, by threats, there were even a lot of, there were actually protected tenancies in those days. So there were people who'd been there for 30 years or whatever with protected tenancies. They were just basically thugged out, you know, like, just intimidated, and some of them were quite old. They were just quite literally incapable of resisting. They were just dragged out, and basically the argument was, oh, they were always given alternative accommodation, which meant they were shoved into really crappy boarding houses around the place and stuff like that, you know, half the time without their stuff. You know, they just got dragged out with a couple of bags of stuff and just chucked in a boarding house, and they really weren't capable of resisting very much, you know? And so there's really, really appalling stories of one sort or another, you know? But it did take them a while to do it, and so it was long enough for us to start to actually organise to block it. But it just came out of the blue, you know. It just bang landed on everyone, you know. And, I lived in this street called Sinead Avenue off the end of Victoria Street, and so I wasn't directly in the line of fire in that sort of sense. But I'd already been involved with the Builders Labourers a bit already. Because about a year or two before, which is about the time the very first green bands happened, well, they actually came out of my art practice. I mean, I was doing these artworks which involved all sorts of participatory stuff, and they involved manipulating the way art viewers moved through the gallery spaces and stuff. I was looking at all this, and I was getting really, you know, not happy with it at all. I mean, everyone thought it was sort of fairly radical, but I actually sort of found it more and more contrived and And, you know, not, I was sort of wondering, what's the point of this, you know? And it suddenly struck me at the time that the first green bands occurred that, look, if what I was doing was trying to actually play with public spaces and the way people acted in them and try and make people think about them and behave differently in them, well, actually the builders' labourers were doing exactly the same thing, you know, on a really massive scale to a much, with much more point to it, you know? And I was just starting to develop this whole theory of what it is artists should do. And it was a theory that basically artists should be involved in cultural change in one shape or another and use whatever was available to them to do it. And so you could use unionism to do it as much as anything else, you know? And it suddenly struck me that the builders' labourers, and not just the builders' labourers' leadership, but the builders' labourers as an entire group, were probably the best artists in the country, in actual fact, you know? and so that... that got me really interested, and through a variety of means, I actually got involved in working with them, and I was actually on some committees. It was more culturally involved because they had bands on a theatre, for instance, in the city, and I got involved. I was very involved in the Contemporary Arts Society, which is probably the main artists association at the time, or artists sort of organisation. And so I became a representative on the committee around the theatre thing with the builders' labourers and with Actors' Equity and with stuff like that. So I got to know all the leadership and I was fairly involved in it. When the Victoria Street thing blew up, right, the first people to start doing anything about it was a guy called Arthur King. And he lived in a building where another artist, Joe Zabo, and his girlfriend, Bonnie McDougall, who were close friends of mine, Joe actually exhibited at the same gallery as me, and they knew what I'd been doing. So they rang me up and sort of said, well, could I help? Could I come and help, right? And so I actually went off with Arthur and Bonnie to a couple of Coalition of Resident Action Group meetings and to meetings with the BLs and stuff like that. But I didn't play that much of a role in it at first, right? This was around the time that the evictions and things were happening.
Yeah,
you know?
No, it's just interesting that you're saying there's sort of a context that this was occurring in terms of the BLF had already started doing green bands, a lot of which supported social housing call social housing now.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, because what had already started to happen, all these things started to happen more or less... around the same time, there was the Rocks stuff, where the whole of the Rocks, which had been in a slightly different way to Victoria Street, but nonetheless long-term working-class housing, it was basically all meant to be knocked down and high-rise office buildings built there. Right? There was other stuff going on over at Waterloo Redfern, where there was already a lot of high-rise public housing, but the idea was to knock down even more of the suburbs and build more of it. And so that was a slightly different fight again, which was to stop that sort of really bleak high-rise public housing, but in a context where people wanted public housing. They just didn't want that sort of public housing, right? And also similar things have been going on down in Woolloomooloo below Victoria Street, which is Woolloomooloo is sort of valley between the Central Business District and the Potts Point Ridge where Central Street is, where Victoria Street is. And it likewise was being bought up mostly by a developer called Sid Londish, who just used to demolish his house as he bought it. And so he actually decimated, you know, about half the suburb by the time there was a green band put on it. And it had just become this weird wasteland of half-demolished buildings and empty blocks. And, you know. So there was all this stuff starting to happen, right? And the builders' labourers would only put things on if there was some sort of resident call for it and if there was an operating resident organisation. They never took, as a principle, they never took action on their own behalf like that. So you had to actually get up and prove that you had some operating local organisation, which is what Arthur did. Arthur really got to work and just set up this whole thing, which, as I said, I didn't actually have a lot to do with, in fact, you know, because I was still up around the corner. So I just had a couple of little early involvements and a few meetings and things.
So this was the Victoria Street Resident Action Group.
But I'm not quite sure of the exact time span involved. It was only a month or 6 weeks or, you know, 2 months or period. There was a sort of stabilisation where they hadn't quite got everybody out, but everything had been sort of like frozen a bit, you know. And there was a green ban on it, and you know, everything just was sort of a bit stopped, right? when Tiemann's guys decided to basically break this by kidnapping Arthur. You know, he just disappeared on the street. Right? And I got hysterical phone calls from my friend Bonnie, you know, who lived next to him, you know, sort of, and a whole lot of other people. Arthur had been sort of involved in what was known as the Sydney Libertarians, who are like left libertarian, yeah, not like American libertarians, you know, they're sort of anarchists basically, but left libertarians, socialist libertarians, you know, and he'd been really involved with them to some degree, and so a whole heap of them piled in, and they included people who I already knew, like Wendy Bacon and you know, Liz Fell and Darcy Waters and Rudolf Smilder and a whole lot of other ones that I got to meet over time, Sue Varga, and so that was a whole social group in itself. They all piled in, people like me piled in. We all basically then within days had taken over and set up a much bigger and much more politically aware sort of organisation, because we had more contacts, and we had contacts with the media, and we had contacts in law, you know, lawyers and judges even, and people like that. And we quickly pulled on a meeting where Mundy just basically got up and said, you know, if anything happens to Arthur King, nothing will ever be built in Victoria Street, ever, you know. And there was this sort of silence for another day, and then suddenly Arthur just popped up on the street, you know, like wide-eyed and terrified, and basically just went into hiding after that. And it was ages before we really sort of found out what happened. I mean, Arthur was so intimidated and terrified, as you would be, you know. Everyone really felt for him. We knew something really bad had happened, you know. Like, everyone knew. He'd been kidnapped, you know. We knew all that, you know. Like, they'd basically re-intimidated him. They thought by knocking him out of it, you know, they could sort of break the whole thing. And, in fact, all they did was expand it into something much bigger, you know, much more public, much more. You know.
Yeah, I mean, the intimidation sounds pretty full-on all round. I mean, you had, right from the beginning, as you were saying, just these thugs turning up, evicting people. Apparently they were sort of doing patrols around the street a lot of the time, and then kind of culminating, I think there were some examples I read about where the police were coming down and sort of warning Arthur, you know, back off. So what was the role of the police in all
well,
of this?
Well, the police were on the other side, you know. I mean, it was a time when Sydney police were notoriously corrupt. I mean, there's always police corruption, you know, but I mean, there's also, to give them their due, there's always police that aren't corrupt as well. There's always police that try and just do the best within the thing. This was one of the worst possible stages, you know. It had full-on political corruption. This is Robert Askin, or Robin Askin, as he really was premier. And he was notoriously corrupt. I mean, he was just getting, you know, money in paper bags from gambling and from abortion clinics and from all sorts of stuff like that, all of which they would then proceed to condemn publicly, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know, while the cops ran this standover operation with them, you know. King's Cross itself was pretty much run by, you know, organised crime, you know, like Abe Saffron, and, you know, in particular, you know, who had lots of things going on there, you know, strip clubs and things like that, you know, and drugs and all sorts of stuff like that. And he was paying the cops and whatever. And the story always was with Tiemann that Tiemann himself, you know, had a taste for young girls, and Tiemann had become friends of Saffron through Saffron's prostitution things and stuff like that. So when he really needed help, you know, he recruited Saffron on the one hand, and he recruited Fred Cray, who was a former cop, and that's a whole story in himself, Fred Cray. But between the two of them, they recruited the standover guys to do all the dirty work. So, I mean, the cops came down and did their part in it as well. They came down to intimidate us, as well as the straight-out thugs coming down to intimidate us. And all we really had was our ability to stir up a bit of attention in the media, you know, and stage various events and stuff like that. We had lots of journalists, friends, so we could stage attention. But it was a time when people simply didn't believe that stuff. You would say, you know, the police are corrupt, you know, politicians are corrupt. No one would publicly acknowledge that. Now it's almost, You know, such a standard thing that it's hard to prove that, no, that isn't always what the problem is. The problem is often much more complex than that. Everyone, all politicians are corrupt, you know, it's like, which isn't actually an answer to a lot of things. You know, things are more complex than that. This was a time when you couldn't get anyone to actually admit that there was such a thing as corrupt police and corrupt cops. But just to give you an idea, I mean, Victoria Street was notoriously the worst, most violent, most scary resident action group, like resident action, you know. Throughout its entire time, it was a scene of thuggery and violence and really, really scary stuff. And just to give you some sense of that, Fred Cray, who had, he'd left the cops at that stage, but the reason he left is because one of the main detectives he was working with, they were actually a sort of fairly well-known team. The other guy's name will come back to me at some point. But they had a bit of a falling out over bribes, mainly because the other guy actually, strangely enough, did have one principle, which was that he wouldn't take drug money. And Cray really started taking large-scale drug money, and they had a big falling out over it. Cray actually shot this guy in police headquarters, right? Killed him in police headquarters, went over and typed a suicide note on the typewriter, you know, and just left it next to the body, you know, and got away with it. He got away with it. Everyone knew he'd done it, and he got away with it, you know. But left the police force shortly thereafter because even his fellow cops thought that was just going a little bit too far. you could do all sorts of things, but shooting your off-sider in the police office toilets was actually a bit too extreme, you know. But that's the sort of people you were up against. You're up against people who really would stop at nothing. So the fact that Arthur didn't get killed is really because they thought it was better tactically to not kill him, you know, rather than because any other scruple they would have had, you know.
Now, after that, the sort of intimidation and evictions continued, and it seems like most of the people had sort of been thrown off the street, but then sort of Mick Fowler...
There weren't a lot of people left, right? I mean, one of the great unsung heroes of it, who really doesn't get that much of a mention, is Marcel Clemens and his wife and kids. They were legal tenants as well as Mick, right? What happened with Mick? And they stayed pretty much the whole time, right through the whole time. But Mick's story was a more interesting one because Mick had a protected tenancy. He was away at sea. He came back and discovered his room had just been emptied out. So they'd paid his mother, you know, like his mother was a sort of figure in the street. His mother was a bit of a, you know, funny character. They just paid off his mother, you know, and Mick threw a real tantrum about it, as you would, and just we all got together with the BLs and the resident action group, and we got all this stuff, and we just basically busted back in. Put him back in his room again. There's actually a great photo of the day we did it. It was all standing out the front of the building with Mick in the middle. Mick was one of those really wonderful people who, it's funny because he's always presented as this leader of the whole thing. He wasn't he wasn't leadership material, but he was really good figurehead material. He was really one of the nicest people I've ever met in my life. This really genuine, you know, and tough, but not nasty tough, you know. Just he wasn't going to let these guys bully him, and that was that, you know. And he was really going to stand up for it. And he had a sort of political history. He'd been involved in the Seamen's Union and stuff like that. But he also was an artist, you know. He was a jazz musician as well.
I've heard the single.
and he'd been a boxer, you know. So he had everything. He was working class boxer, jazz musician, you know, and seaman, you know. Like he had ticked all the boxes, and a really lovely guy to boot, you know. And so he just wasn't going to let these guys push him around, you know. He had his rights and he was going to stick up for them, and that was that. They hadn't done it legally, you know. They couldn't prove that they'd done it legally. Oh, we gave his mother money. That didn't mean anything, you know. That wasn't him, you know. And that might have worked with other people. Didn't work with Mick, you know. And so once Mick was back in his room, they had this problem. They had at least one legal tenant that they couldn't dislodge, and that was enough to hold everything up for starters. They had a second legal tenant in the form of Marcel and his wife, but they were virtually on a 5-8 lease, and so they could have had their lease terminated and been pushed out, you know. So, which is in fact what happened to them, but they didn't go. They just stayed there, you know. But they didn't have the same legal basis as Mick. And so Mick was the legal linchpin to the whole thing from there on in terms... To the degree we needed a legal linchpin, he was it, you know, and nothing was going to shift.
What some jolly squatters camp in Victoria Street. There they live for months on end. They fought and struggled for their own community, the rights of the tenants to defend. Green bands forever, green bands forever, green bands forever in Victoria Street. We sang as we hopped from chimney top to chimney top. Green bands forever in Victoria Street. Down come the coppers, mounted on their rescue vans. Up come the thugs' bands, one, two, three. We laugh as we struggle down behind the barricades. You'll never drive us away, said we. Green bands forever, green bands forever, green bands forever in Victoria Street. We laugh, we hop from chimney top to chimney top. Green bands forever in Victoria Street. Out come the squatters, carried by the constable. Into the wagon, one, two, three. The thugs with their crowbars smash all the premises. They cost him dough, but the coppers come free. Green bands forever, green bands forever, green bands forever in Victoria Street. We sang, we hop from chimney top to chimney top. Green bands forever in Victoria Street. Up jumped a squatter high into the chimney pot. You'll have some trouble to get me, said he. His voice could be heard as the moon shone on the chimney top. Green bands forever in Victoria Street. Green bands forever, green bands forever, green bands forever in Victoria Street. We sang as we hopped from chimney top to chimney top. Green bands forever in Victoria Street. People of Sydney fighting for Victoria Street. Still keep a watch by the sycamore tree. They are sycamores, you know, folks. And the green band will stay on fellows and their property. Green bands forever in Victoria Street. King's Cross, the top of William. Victoria Street forever!
Hi, my name's Ian McIntyre, and you're listening to a program about the Victoria Street Squats. Just then you heard a track called Green Bands Forever by the Green Band, which was recorded in 1979. The trad jazz group was led by Mick Fowler, who we were just hearing about, and also featured Builders Labourers Federation leader Bob Pringle on bongos and gourd. Now we'll return to the interview with Ian Millis. And around this time, it seems like people started squatting the area as well.
Well, again, another stalemate developed, you know, after a while, where nothing was going anywhere. And, you know, we couldn't quite, you could sort of see the whole thing just slipping away as it sort of stopped being topical news and stuff like that, you know.
But Tiemann was having his own problems with the, in terms of his, the heritage listing and...
Yes. And there were a whole range of issues like that having to be resolved in one way or other. But you also have to remember there was no heritage legislation in those days. So the heritage thing was more an issue of public perception, you know. But as long as he was seen as a person who was going to demolish this beautiful street, he really was the bad guy in publicity terms. And a lot of the publicity that he got was in those heritage terms. It was just starting to be that sort of heritage awareness, you know. But for us and for people like me, I mean, I've actually been involved in the heritage industry, you know, as such, you know. So I had the background and I knew a lot about it as architecture and I had all that interest in it. But nonetheless, for like most people who are actually involved in the actions, for us it was a thing about community as much as anything. And the point about the architecture wasn't that, oh, it was fantastic architecture, which it was. But it was architecture which had been modified and adapted in such a way to create a really flexible community base, you know, like in a way that it's very hard to create artificially. You can't build the sort of architecture that will generate a community like that. It has to actually evolve over 100 or 150 years, and Victoria Street had it. You know. So we were defending the architecture in order to defend the community, yes. Whereas other people were tending to defend the architecture just as an end in itself. And wouldn't it be good if nice middle-class people lived there who looked after it?
Yes, you know? But nevertheless, I guess the heritage thing was part of that sort of slowing him up, and he did have a meeting at some point with the action group, I read.
Oh, yeah, we had a lot of meetings with him.
Okay. How was that on the one hand, you've got this guy.
He was beside himself, you know. I mean, because he had all these conspiracy theories that who was paying us, you know, who's paying you to do this? And he couldn't get his head around the fact that actually no one was paying us to do it, you know. Like somehow or other, had to be someone paying us to do it, you know. And so he'd see these alternating things. Should he bribe us more? You know, what could he promise to get rid of? You know, what could he do? What did he have to do to solve this, you know? And because he was basically a pretty slippery guy, it was always like that to him. You know, everybody could be bought. If they couldn't be bought, they could be intimidated. And it was always, you could see alternating between these things of how you'd do that, because that's how he worked. You know?
And
neither of those things worked with us, so he had a real problem.
And eventually he did get around the heritage thing by doing some redesigns.
Well, there became a series of proposals by different architects, big-name architects too. It's a sort of tactic that's been used forever since. Get a big-name architect to put up a proposal, and then when you build it, get somebody else to build it, you know. But that was the thing. And the architects he put up were architects who I sort of knew or actually knew or knew of, you know, and at least in their way, I had a certain amount of respect for, like Neville Grusman and like Ken Woolley, and you know they were good architects. You know, they still put up really crap proposals, as it happens, and the proposals as such tended to be, eventually, they were just facadism. You know, so you just have the series of towers sitting on a podium, but the front of the podium was the front of the old buildings or something like that, which is really what ultimately got done. You know, yes. A certain number of the buildings survived within this context, but overall, you know, the whole block has this huge big podium with a heap of buildings, big towers.
Mm. And as you say, that has been the trend in sort of dealing with heritage
ever since.
So
there's one other aspect we said about the heritage thing too, because we used it ourselves as part of the thing, we got hoisted with our own petard in a way at a certain point, because the National Trust, and I mean this was another annoying thing, because I had you know, one quite good friend who was actually on the board of the National Trust at the time. In fact, my wife has since been on the board of the National Trust, you know, like so I've always been sort of within range of it and known about it, you know. At the time of this, there was a good friend of mine who was actually on the board of the National Trust. The National Trust actually agreed to one of these proposals, and that sort of basically sold us out, you know. And the problem with the National Trust was the National Trust, while obviously being very interested in heritage, was more interested in it as architecture, and also just found all of this stuff a bit basically, because they're all very conservative people, you know. They all vote Liberal, you know. I mean, and they found all of this sort of dirty, unwashed hippies protesting down in Victoria Street was really as threatening to them as it was to someone like Frank Tiemann. You know, they wanted heritage saved. They didn't want it saved like this, you know. And so there was real complexities in the way all of that played itself out as well. And basically, at a certain point, they just sold us out. You know, they sold us out for the fronts of the buildings.
Yeah. Okay, so when did the squatting part become part of the tactic?
Well, I'm trying to remember what the exact date is.
I think we're looking
somewhere around the middle of the year. Around June, yeah. And first off, we just basically, we staged it, you know. We actually really did stage it. In fact, what happened was Rudolf Smilder and I went round we worked it all out. We had it all planned out. We knew which buildings we were going to go into. Rudolf Smilder and I actually went down the back stairs, down along Braum Street, and came back up the other end of the street and sneaked into the buildings that we were going to occupy, the first two big buildings, which were up towards the harbour end of the street. And we actually got inside there and actually secured them, spent an hour in there and secured them and had everything all locked up and locks changed and all this sort of stuff. And then meanwhile, down the other end of the street, they called up the media, and a whole bunch of people staged this big march down the street and got down to these houses and we opened up the doors and they walked in, you know, and that was it. We had the buildings. It was all done for the TV cameras. Mm. The whole thing was very much a media thing. But then once we were there, like, we stayed, you know, like, we just stayed. And within a couple of weeks, we had something like another 10 buildings along the street, at various points along the street. The problem was that as the buildings had been emptied out, the thugs had systematically smashed them up, you know, to make them as unlivable as possible. And so we had a limited range of buildings that we could actually move into. Some of them were just too destroyed to be possible. But the ones that we could move into, over the next couple of months, we got control of nearly all of them. And then this amazing standoff developed because they still were patrolling the street and stuff like that. And so we patrolled the street. And so we had these sort of like mutual patrols passing each other in the street. and we had everything very, very, you know, tightly locked up. And there was always people in there 24 hours a day. And basically we started to rebuild a community of some sort. It wasn't the same community that had been there before, but, you know, obviously because it was much younger. You know,
So what sort of people were involved now in terms of age and background and all that sort of thing?
A lot of them were students. A lot of them were, but not all of them were students. I mean, they were actually sort of people who were just young professionals. I mean, we had a guy there who was a vet, for instance. You know, we had a whole range of just, it was a more radicalised, you know, younger group of people as you got in the mid-70s, you know, or early-70s, stuff like that. But it did tend to be, you know, younger people overall. The older people around tended to be some of the older libertarians, people like Darcy and Ruloff, who were themselves, they're only 40 or something like that, you know, they weren't that old, you know. That tended to be the upper limit of it. There weren't that many people older than that, you know. It was too dangerous, you know, it was dangerous, it was seriously dangerous.
So what motivated people, do you think, to put up with that danger? Was it that there was this
there was a real anger.
Sort of,
there were just, you know, there were people who were just attracted to the whole thing because there had been this growing anger all over Sydney about what was happening. See, all through the 60s leading up to this, there had been endless redevelopment all over the city with some of the most ugly modernist buildings you could ever imagine. You know, this was an age of very bad modernist architecture and all sorts of parts of Sydney had been really badly destroyed. And people had just been this resentment building up, you know. And it was really commonplace resentment. It had become right across the whole community. And there was also a sort of, even though it was never publicly acknowledged, the corruption and stuff, people knew about it, right? And we became not just a centre of resident action as such, but we became this driving force in terms of raising issues of corruption, you know, about police and about politics. So all through this, we were publishing little weekly newsletters and things like that. And we actually began all these various investigations into who owned stuff and what was the connection between them. There'd been a little bit of this going on before Victoria Street, but not much, but there had been a bit of it in local council elections and stuff like that. It had surfaced, you know. But we actually turned it into a much bigger thing. And there were a series of people involved in the Resident Action Group who went on to become very well-known journalists who were the ones who then exposed on a really large scale the corruption in New South Wales over the next 5 or 6 years. But it actually began with our company searches and things in Victoria Street, you know. I mean, that's obviously a later consequence of it, but you can see the sort of things we were starting to raise were bringing in people who had all sorts of different interests rather than just interests about architecture or anything like that, you know. We did become a real focus of this sort of politics. But then again, also, we were just one of many resident action groups, but we were the youngest, most radicalised, you know, and most publicised one in many ways.
And were there many people squatting around Sydney already, or...?
There were none.
Right.
So there hadn't been a squat, as far as we've ever been able to ascertain, then. We didn't even know then about the other one very much, but there had been one just after the Second World War in what was then a building which was in Fitzroy Gardens. And, in fact, the Communist Party had organised that, strangely enough, given how conservative they were. And that was really a carryover from some of the... There'd been squats during the Depression, you know, during the 30s and stuff like that. But there really hadn't been anything really serious or politicised. Or there may have been random illegal things which weren't politicised, or they were just people, you know, tossing down in houses.
Okay, so this sort of kicked off that then, as because squatting became quite large in Sydney over the, you know, in Glebe and so forth.
And all those other ones actually were spin-offs from Victoria Street. Like, a lot of the people who set those ones up had actually been in Victoria Street at some point or another. And or that stuff came out of actions, because Victoria Street people, we didn't just stick to Victoria Street. We went and provided the bodies for protests in other areas, including in the Rocks and also the Western Distributor ones. We were really involved in anti-car stuff. And so the Western Distributor, which went straight from the CBD across Glebe, Pyrmont, through there, we were really involved in all the protests around that. And that's where the next big lot of squats set up. And several of the people involved in those squats had been in Victoria Street, like Elvis Kipman, for instance.
And all right. So, and how long were you feeling that you might be able to hold on onto the street? I mean,
We really didn't know. Basically, the whole thing was being driven by legal stuff. We managed to actually create a pretense of legality in various ways, you know, because we actually paid rent into accounts and stuff like that, and we used various common law things. I mean, we had some really good lawyers on tap, right? And we could at least put up a pretense of a legal position, which then had to be disproved. You know, so even though it might have been a bit rickety, you know, they had to go through the motions to actually get orders against us and whatever. And that slowed them down in terms of doing anything. They couldn't move without actually having had these sort of court orders and stuff. And that meant we actually managed to hold it all together right up until early 1974. So it was going for 6-7 months, you know, which was miraculous given the extreme conditions that it was operating under, you know. And it was only after they finally got, I think it was John Cox, who they took the actual legal action against, right? And once they had findings on that, saying no, he hasn't got any sort of legal basis for being there or whatever. Well, then they just basically mounted like this military operation against us.
Okay, so during this time, so you had these various legal stalls, I guess, to sort of, and you were doing the newsletter, and it sounds like a lot of sort of protest, but I guess there must have been a lot of involved in sort of just repairing and improving the street after all this destruction. And how was that done? Was that all sort of done communally, or did people?
Anybody who was in a building just did their own bit. Right. Basically, right? And we had ongoing meetings all the time so that everybody just knew what the current status of stuff was and things like that. But this was hardly a centralised sort of operation, you know. There was probably a core group of, which varied in size, but it would have been probably about a dozen people, you know, who drove the whole thing along pretty much. But that's not to minimise the other, you know, 80 or 90 people who all were really involved, but in their particular area.
So people would move in, set up their house however they wanted, fix it up, but also sort of attend, you know, have a clue about what was going on and do the street patrol bit and all that.
You could see how that could go wrong, but it never did. You know, like all the people were in sympathy with each other, and you tended to come because you knew other people. It wasn't a thing where someone would barge in without knowing already what was going on there. It was too scary to do that, you know. So, but see, what has to be said too is that there had been quite a lot of squatting going on in London before this, you know, and so we also had input from that, because we knew people who'd been in London squats, and we were in contact with them, and they actually gave us lots of pointers on things from overseas, you know. So none of them were there with us, but we knew them, and we could be in contact with them and stuff like that.
And tell us about the squat where you lived.
I never really lived there full time. I lived there for weeks at a time, but I also had a house somewhere else. I lived somewhere else as well. And so I lived for a while in the first one down at 5759, which was the very first one we moved into. I used to stay down there fairly regularly, quite a lot. And then a later stage, I used to spend a fair bit of time in the one up the other end where Wendy was, Wendy Bacon and Teresa Brennan, and which was the same building as Mick Fowler or behind Mick Fowler's, you know. And because Mick, you know, Mick and I became good friends, so I used to spend a lot of time with Mick and stuff. So they're the two ends of the street. The other place where I also spent a lot of time was the stables, which was sort of like our office. It was behind in one or two buildings up along from Mick's building. So it was again up the William Street end of the whole area. And it was exactly that. It was an actual renovated old stables building, you know, which had a kitchen and toilet and stuff like that. And we used to use that as our, I don't know who'd actually been there originally, but we very early on took it over as our office effectively. And it was a very easily barricaded building, had great big solid wooden doors. And it was very secure, no ground floor windows or anything like that. So.
And what was the atmosphere generally on the street? I mean, it seems like you had this, obviously the intimidation that we've talked about, but you also had, you must, as you were saying, you're building this community. I mean, people must have been having a lot of fun and excitement as well.
There was a lot of fun. You know, it was actually on the whole quite a good place, you know. I mean, after a while, they left us alone. They just watched us, you know. They just kept a watch on us. At one point, someone actually broke into their office. See, they had an office building half along the street, a sort of old real estate agent's office. And at one point, someone broke into their office and actually got into their files and discovered, for instance, you know, that at this stage I'd moved from St. Ed Avenue and moved to about two suburbs away, right out of there. And they discovered photos of me at my house out there. Like, so they'd been following me out there and they'd been following other people around all sorts of places. And so you knew that basically you were being spied on. So they had this pretty clear list of who was who. And, you know, they may have had spies amongst us, but I doubt that. I think they just sort of slowly worked it all out, you know. But they were very seriously tracking us and, you know, and you know, trying to work out who to target and, you know, things like that. And that's a bit scary when you suddenly realise that virtually you're on a sort of death list, you know. These people who are following you around all the time and keeping tabs on you and everything you do, you know. But you've got to remember, they also had the police, you know, in their pocket as well. I mean, so there's all sorts of things. It was very, none of us were naive about what we were up against, which is unlike Juanita, who was completely naive about what she was up against. You know?
So in terms of keeping your spirits up and were there a lot of parties and music and
I mean, in a sense, it was always a bit of a low-level party, you know. I mean, there was always things going on all the time, every night, and, you know. And you had to sort of make your own entertainment, you know, because you didn't have much choice, you know. Like, I mean, half the resources in the place had been demolished of one sort or another, you know. And they're pretty rough places, so you had to sort of, you know, basically entertain yourself and stuff like that. But there were, you know, there were things like there was kindergarten type things set up at once. I just saw childcare things set up. It just had a good, lively community where everybody sort of got together and, you know, entertained each other all the time. So, I mean, it was a bit of a, it was funny because none of us were what you'd call hippies in any conventional sense. We were all too politicised for that, you know, but it was like that. It was like this big communal, you know, look after each other, good fun sort of place like that. But all the time being observed by these really scary thugs.
And Mick Fowler did a single at one point. Do you remember what the story with that was?
Mick actually had a group, you know, the Fowl House Five.
Okay.
He had it for years, you know. So he used to go and when he was back from not off on a ship, he'd come back and this was a time when there was around. The whole inner city area there, one of the standard things was those sort of Dixieland jazz bands in beer gardens, in pubs. And there were a lot of those sort of bands around playing in those inner city pubs around Paddington and Surrey Hills and stuff like that. And so Mick had one of those bands and he used to go up and play. And so there's actually one of the, I think one of the nicest Victoria Street artefacts is a film which seems to have sort of disappeared. I've been thinking, I've got to really go and try and find it, done by a guy called Lee Chittick, who I'd all known from earlier on. He'd been involved in art stuff that I knew about, where he did a film about May Day in 74, I think, something like that. It might have been later. I'm not quite sure. It was done within a year or two of the end of Victoria Street. It was while Mick was still actually in Victoria Street, but, and it was about Mick and his band, you know, going off to May Day, and they were on the back of one of the trucks and playing jazz, and it's just really, really cheerful, good fun, great film, you know, about Mick and his jazz and and of course Mick. Would write all these songs. There are a huge number of Victoria Street songs, in fact, you know, a really amazing number of them, in fact, and or about green bands or about inner city politics, which came out at that time. But instead of being the usual folk song dirges, which a lot of those songs often are, these were all jazz ones. They're really lively jazz songs about stuff like that. So, cool. And Mick was just very good and very entertaining jazz band.
To get back to the more sort of intense and tragic side of it, in September 73, there was a squat set alight and a young Indigenous woman was burnt to death. And it's sort of interesting, Shane, person I work on the site with, in the article he wrote, he sort of noted that in most of the books that have been written, it's almost treated as an aside. And he's sort of like...
It's never been an aside to me.
It was just an interesting thing that it's almost been, in most of the popular histories of it, it's almost been sort of glossed over. So what are your memories?
I suspect one of the reasons why it's treated as an aside is it's not because she's Indigenous. It's because there was actually three or four people in that house, right? And there were some other people around who weren't really part of the main squatting thing. I mean, these were basically homeless people.
Yep.
You know, who we'd created this environment where also homeless people and other people that could actually move in and be reasonably protected. I mean, we'd look after them as part of their whole thing, if they didn't participate in much in the whole thing. And we've debated amongst ourselves exactly what happened because I mean, I think it's pretty certain it was just accidental. You know, they burnt the house down themselves. You know, like you know, they had candles or something like that. But one of the things which went on, which made that more complex, is in the same way that we protected them and kept them as part of our sort of group around the edges of it, the thugs targeted them slightly because they could target them more easily than they could target us, and so they also used to get intimidated and bullied and stuff like that. And we wouldn't even know it had happened and stuff, right? And so there was always this concern that, in fact, there had been an arson thing. And they would do things which were meant to be an example to us, you know, sort of you're next, you know, sort of type things. And so there was always a concern that house had been set on fire by them as an example to the rest of us. You know, and it was always hard to unpick all of that.
And I assume the police, of course, never investigated it properly.
No, they don't give stuff. Yeah. No, they took the bodies away and said, God, that's terrible, but it serves you right, you all shouldn't be here, you know, was the general.
And how did people respond to something as like that? How, you know,
oh, everybody was just like devastated, you know, just absolutely horrified. I mean, we were horrified at our own failure that we hadn't managed to sort of protect them, and we're horrified that it had happened, and we read it as in some sense being a threat to us, even if it was an accident, it was a threat to us because it was an example of what could happen, you know, in one of the other houses, you know, so it wasn't something you could look at lightly. But then there were other things too. I mean Elvis Kipman ended up hospitalized after being pushed down the stairs by the thugs at one stage, you know. You know, there were all sorts of things like that. You know, there was still low level violence going on all the time. You know, I mean, they wouldn't refrain from, you know, having a go at you if they met you in one of the dark alleys, sort of thing. You know, but they weren't going to make any easy big confrontations with us either. It was a standoff, but they were quite willing to take advantage of any situation that fell their way all of a sudden.
Yeah. Know? So in terms of the, you mentioned a little bit earlier, but in terms of how things were organised, there was sort of an inner group, it sounds like, who was doing most stuff, but how did you go about, was there sort of any formal kind of process, or was it more of an informal just sort of?
No, it was very informal. With the good and bad things of those informal things. I mean, sometimes in those informal things, you know, certain people just come to dominate by, you know. I mean, you had a very politically aware group of people who had tried to be careful about that, you know, and we had some sort of informal rules, which was much for self-protection as anything else, which was, for instance, no one could go off to meetings on their own or anything like that. Everybody always went with probably at least probably three people, you know. That was so we had several people to report back, but also nothing could happen to them, you know, because it was dangerous. I mean, and so there were a whole range of things like that went on, you know. So there were always, we made sure that there were plenty of different viewpoints of interpretations of everything that happened. And we were all generally within a range, you know, politically sympathetic sort of range of some sort or another. So no major problems blew up in terms of that. You know, so.
Now, after John Cox's appeal against his conviction for trespassing, which you mentioned earlier, failed in early December 73, people began barricading houses because I guess he knew something.
We knew something was going to happen. Yeah.
And what sort of barricades did you put up?
Oh, they were beautiful. I don't know whether you've ever seen it, but in the City Squatter, I actually wrote an art review of the barricades.
Okay, I think that was missing from the...
Yeah, well, it was partly me satirising my own art world background, but it was also a reflection on the fact that they were... They were more beautiful than they were effective.
Right. So when you say beautiful, what, they were they had murals on them?
No, but they were rather over-designed in lots of cases, you know. Right. But you only had to give them one whack in the right place and the whole lot fell down.
Okay.
Right? I mean, I always, it wasn't in Victoria Street, but I always tell people about there's this big, quite famous demonstration down in the Rocks where we occupied this building, which was already half demolished. The roof had been taken off it, right? But it was this big warehouse building with these big warehouse doors, right? So we raced in there one morning and we actually, in this sort of big open space, there was these four walls with no roof, you know, these big doors. We gathered up all the rubble and all the spare wood on the whole place and jammed it all up behind the doors, and, you know, so, you know, huge barricades 5 metres deep of piled up stuff. And the cops arrived, took one look at it and opened the doors outwards. We didn't think that the hinges actually went both ways because we'd opened them in. You know? Didn't occur to anyone they opened out. Well, that's a bit like what happened in Victoria Street in some cases, you know. But what we did was we put, you know, we got form ply over all the windows, and we had big bracing against it. And in one of the houses I was in, we not only just put form ply against all the doors and things like that, but we actually punched holes in the walls. So we did a bit of damage ourselves. We punched holes in the walls and wedged scaffolding against it. You know, big scaffolding bars behind it and wedged it all. And, it was serious stuff, but. But off in many cases, it was on one side of the building. If you went around the back door was still open. Or in other cases, not in the one I was in, it was barricaded up all around. But then you got to remember, these guys knew that we were doing it. And so when they arrived, they came with axes and hammers, and they just quite literally, in some cases, in one building further up the street, which was pretty well barricaded, they didn't even bother knocking down the barricades. They just ripped the roof off and came down through the ceiling, you know. Like, they didn't care what damage they did, you know, because they were there to do more damage to make sure no one could ever live in them again. So they just went to town and just, with axes, just chopped their way through this stuff, you know. And it's pretty scary when you've built this really solid sort of barricade to then have to sit there for 3/4 of an hour as someone... three, four guys with axes chop their way through it to get at you, you know. It was pretty horrifying in its way. My favourite one really was someone who I had an argument with him beforehand and told him that, look, I knew enough about medieval military history to know this was not a good idea, which was that he actually left a hole through his, because he said, I'll just get a big piece of scaffolding and I'll just shove it at them and sort of go, oh, that isn't going to work. Yes, it will. They won't be able to get anywhere near it, you know. Like, because he shoved it out, and the guy with the big hammer on the other way went, whack, came straight back in his face. I told you.
So this was the eviction that occurred on January the 3rd.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. And talking about songs earlier on, right, everybody pretty much was dragged out on the 3rd. There were hundreds of people there. it was immediately broadcast all over Sydney, and we had phone trees set up and all sorts of things like that. So not only did every resident action group in the inner city then pile into Victoria Street in support of us, but just people just appeared off the street that you'd never heard of. People used to just come and just, well, I was in a prison, in a cell, you know, but people I know who were there on the street who were obviously part of the organiser of the resident action group, they said people just come up and just hand the money, you know, like, here, keep going, here, have money, you know. And in fact, there were several guys up on the roofs of the houses. They'd got up on the roofs of the house and they wouldn't get down, and they'd actually got themselves, jammed themselves in the tops of chimneys and stuff like that. And the police did sort of reckless stuff that cops would never do these days, I don't think, where they actually set fires in the chimneys to try and smoke them out and stuff like that.
Wasn't there some story, though, where they put something over the chimney and all the smoke went back
to the guy himself was jammed in the chimney, so this smoke was supposed to get him out. It was Keith Mullins, I think. The smoke was supposed to drive him out. In fact, drove all the cops out of from below. You know?
Reversed, yeah.
Didn't quite work, right?
So you got arrested early on, did you?
I got grabbed fairly early on, you know, and basically spent the entire next, you know, 10 hours or whatever in a police cell. But they were there overnight, those guys, right? And and as people started getting out again, well, being bailed out again later in the day, there was a whole lot of very quick organisation started to go on in the streets. And so even if it was completely symbolic, it was very funny, because to entertain the guys up on the roofs, we started organising the whole street into this gigantic choir, you know, singing them all the sort of Green Band songs. But then one of the people, Teresa Brennan, who was very, very witty woman, you know, she used to actually write scripts for Barry Humphries and stuff, right? She was very good at you know, bodging up quick songs and stuff like that. She got there and taught all these people the gendarmes duet, you know. You know, we run them in, we run them in, we run them in, we run them in, you know, that sort of stuff. Right? And so we had the whole song, the whole street singing operetta to these guys singing chimneys up on the roof, you know. the whole thing was actually very funny. I mean, Victoria Street always had that sort of nice edge to it, you know, because it was full of people with arts backgrounds and stuff like that as well. So they always had this other whole very witty aspect to it, you know, and all sorts of fun things like that went on there. You know. Even in the dying moments, you know, people still managed to have fun out of it. You know.
So in terms of them getting the people off the roof, how long did the whole eviction
take? Oh, it took them another, it was nearly an entire day before, it was the next day before they finally got them out, I think, from memory. They were up there for a long time, you know. Eventually they just couldn't stay there any longer, you know, and it was all over. Everyone knew it was over, you know. And all the time they were up there, the thugs were just working their way systematically through every other building in the street, smashing everything, ripping out every bit of plumbing, every bit of wiring, every door. They had trucks there where they just ripped all the doors out of every room, out of everything, and just throwing them on the back of trucks and taking them away. So you see truckloads of cedar doors disappearing down the street, you know. It's just all quite heartbreaking in its way. They weren't going to make it possible for this to happen again. You know, they just destroyed every single thing they could.
Homie, name it is Fred. I'm Sydney born and bred. In the city used to be my homeboy. Cause my heart to grieve, I've had to take my leave. Across the western suburbs we must roam. Boys under concrete and glass, cities disappearing fast. All gone for profit and for plunder. Don't really want to stay, they keep driving us away. Across the western suburbs we must wander. Where is me house, me little terrace house? It's all gone for profit and for plunder. The wreckers of the town come up and knock it down. Across the western suburbs we must wander. Before we even knew it, we were shifted to Mount Druitt. Planners never gave us any say, boy. Really makes us weep, we're just at home to sleep. It takes us hours to get to work each day. Boy, where is the pub, the little local pub, where we used to have a drink when we were dry boys? You can't get in the door, there's carpets on the floor. You won't be
they serve the beer without a tie. Boys living in a box in the western suburb blocks. Places nearly driving us for tears, boys. Polypan badly built, mortgage to the hill. They say it will be out in 40 years. Oh, under concrete and glass, Sydney's disappearing fast. It's all gone for profit and for plunder. No, we really want to stay, they keep driving us away. Across the western suburbs we must wander. Now before the city's wrecked, these developers must be checked. For it's plain to see, they don't give a bugger. And we soon will see the day, if these bandits have their way, we'll all be driven out past Wagga Wagga. Under concrete and glass, Sydney's disappearing fast. It's all gone for profit and for plunder. Don't really want to stay, they keep driving us away. Now across the western suburbs we must wander.
Just then you heard a track called Across the Western Suburbs, as performed by the Green Band in 1979, and that song was originally written by Seamus Gill and Dennis Kevins. Today we're hearing an interview with Ian Millis about the Victoria Street Squats, and we'll continue with that now.
If you can just comment a bit on that sort of last 3 or 4 weeks, did it sort of change greatly? Or
yeah, it did, but it also developed that other thing, that sort of, this is a major crisis. It's sort of like you knew it was the end. You know, we knew it was the end, you know. But we were just going to go down fighting, that's all. And because none of us were stupid, you know, we knew how dangerous it was. We were very aware of trying to go down fighting while making absolutely certain that nobody got injured or hurt or stuff. You know, it was really a serious issue because they were scary people, you know. We knew it would be so much in the public eye that probably we were safe, but there was no guarantee, you know. And we did all have this principle that, you know, nothing's worth dying for, you know. So it was that, you know. But we weren't going to let them, you know, get it easy either.
Yeah.
You know? So, and so to some extent too, we tried to make sure that really vulnerable people weren't there, you know, that everybody was there, knew exactly what was going to happen, knew what they were doing, and once they actually got into the house, there was no fights with them or anything like that. We just, you know, we made them drag us out, but we didn't, you know, we weren't going to have punch-ups in there or anything like that, you know. So it was sort of quite non-violent in that sense, you know, because it wasn't worth it. It just wasn't worth it, you know. But it was a very scary. Look, it's a really interesting thing because, I mean, I think back on now, I was really quite young and obviously people go through much worse things, you know, like in wars and war zones and things like that, right? But it's a really strange thing to learn in your own supposedly calm, civilised society exactly how far they will go if you actually manage to really, really put up resistance, you know? I mean, how far they'll go is they'll kill you, you know? So there is no limit, you know, and that's a really scary thing to learn when you've been brought up really safely and naively in a society like ours, you know. And that was a shock even to people who were older and more knowledgeable than me, you know. I think, you know, it's one of those things that you can never look at your society in the same way again after, you know, because you know something more. Nobody else might even believe you about it, but you know it. You know, and that was the point where we really knew it.
So did you have much of a tip-off that the eviction was coming? Did you have any idea? Or
we didn't. No. We only knew. We knew that it had to happen sometime soon. So we had to work as fast as we could. And then after that, we only managed to get things done a day or two before it did happen. But the thing is, we knew something was happening that within a couple of hours of it happening because we had so many contacts in that whole inner city area, you know, like that whole was full of other resident action group people, including people who lived across the street from police stations. And they started seeing buses pulling up at 4 a.m. and obviously lots of police arriving, because there were several hundred police there, you know. There were a lot of thugs, but the police were there to protect the thugs, basically, you know, and drag us out do the legal bit of it. And yeah, there were buses of police at Darlinghurst and things like that. And so we had people just racing up to us, you know, like, you know, early in the morning saying, they're there, they're going to be here soon. And, you know. Mm. So you could see their operation building up as they
okay.
accumulated all the people.
So you were all, once the street got cleared, I understand you continued with some other sort of protest stuff and
we did things like we put out the City Squatter newspaper, for instance, where we actually documented everything that happened, and it really did document it, because we didn't just write a history of, you know, we wrote sorts of history, just stories of what had happened there, and you know, and it's a very interesting artifact because it has everything from sort of what you just described as literature, you know, just quite literally short stories about life in the street and stuff like that, to stuff which is history. Or personal history of one sort or another. Like I wrote the page two is this big long thing that I wrote with Teresa Brennan, which is just a sort of history of the last couple of weeks, you know, of what it was like being there. But sort of page, I think sort of four and five is this big double page spread that Wendy Bacon did, where she actually goes through all the company structures and things like that, you know, like, and who owned what and who were on the boards of these things and what other things they're connected to and their links into Liberal Party stuff and their links into, you know, all the sort of things like that, all just laid out, you know, documented and laid out. There was another thing which was a history of Victoria Street going back to the 19th century. How did it become Victoria Street? What had been the various sociological and historical changes? That when were these houses built and how did they got there? You know, what had changed them then? And, you know, how did it end up the way it was? So over this sort of 24-page newspaper, we had this whole range of different ways of analysing the history of the place and what had gone on there, whatever. So this was our document to sort of leave behind for people if nothing else happened, you know. But it wasn't the end, because despite all that, Mick was still there.
Mm.
It took them another, you know, 18 months or 2 years, I mean, to finally get Mick out, right? So there were things like that going, and the Green Band was still on. And it wasn't until the intervention, Gallagher's intervention, you know, the federal intervention in the BLs, that the ban came off. And it should be pointed out, the very first ban that came off was Victoria Street.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about that, because I guess all these things were probably meshing together. You had the developers and the state government and the Victorian BLF and Gallagher had sort of been...
And the Master Builders Association.
Yes, sorry.
That's the real key. That's the real key to it, because that's basically, they were the ones funding it. And there was obviously, you know, I can't think of, you know, any evidence of it off the top of my head, except everyone has just taken it for granted that... you know, Tiemann was one of the people funding it.
Mm. So they moved in to deregister the union.
Well, what happened was there was the federal body moved in to take over the state, the state body, right? And there are a whole range of reasons for that. I mean, it ranging from ideological ones, you know, like Gallagher being a Maoist, as opposed to most of the New South Wales BLs who were either Communist Party or Left Labor or whatever, right? There was that level of... And there'd always been that conflict within the union. That had gone on from the year dot. There was the fact that basically Gallagher was corrupt. You know, he was as corrupt as everyone else. And so, you know, you're talking about a corrupt national leadership which was perfectly willing to take money from you know, corrupt developers in New South Wales to destroy the New South Wales branch of the union. And I was really knew them all really well, and without actually being part of the actual organisation, I mean, I knew them really well, and they were not corrupt, the New South Wales guys. They were as straight as the day is long, you know, and what they did was really quite amazing, so idealistically amazing that it's really hard to believe it even happened in retrospect, you know. And so they were destroyed by the corrupt section of their own union. Within a couple of days, basically, they moved in. Everybody who was a member of the New South Wales branch, the New South Wales branch was effectively abolished. So in order to get it, and the builders enforced it. So you couldn't work without having a union ticket. but it had to be a federal office union ticket.
Yes, and I guess all the militants were black banned and so forth.
All the militants weren't allowed to, weren't given tickets. And so effectively the whole lot of them were out of a job. There were hundreds of them at first. Over time it filtered down to about 17, the last 17 real leadership ones, But that in itself was a whole real scary thing. So, that involved endless bashings, violence, murders, Again, that wasn't nice either. Mm.
So they lifted the ban, and then Mick was sort of evicted shortly after that. What's your memories of that?
Well, by that stage, I was really worn out. Basically, I was really worn out. I actually, in late 74, I just went to live in the country and hid for a year, pretty much. Not entirely. I was still involved in a lot of... one of the consequences of this, we'd all been arrested so many times, we'd all been in and out of cells so many times, we all got interested in prison reform. And so we actually then set up the Prisoners Action Group and a women's one, Women Behind Bars, and actually started a whole prison reform movement as a spin-off from all of this, right? And so I did a lot of work on that over the next year or two or three, but I also basically lived up in the country about 150 k's out of Sydney, just to get away from it. It was really taxing, it was really hard, and you really just wanted to get away at a certain point and just stop thinking about it for a while, really did your head in, And that was the sort of state I was in. I ran away from it all to have a rest. But like I say, I kept coming back every week to do a little bit more, but the 6 days of the week I stayed away.
So Mick got, you weren't there when the...
No, I wasn't really there, And I knew about it and all that, but I wasn't there at the time it all happened. And
so
my involvement from that point on just sort of faded out. I got dragged in big time when Juanita disappeared.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Yeah, what...
Well, see, Juanita was a really another whole funny thing because Juanita wouldn't involve herself. Juanita was, an heiress, as she would always remind you. She had that a real sort of ruling class sense of privilege and immunity, that somehow the rules never applied to her, like nothing nasty ever happened to Juanita, sort of thing, She always had money and stuff like that to protect her, but really her ambition was the gentrification of the area in a different way to Frank Tiemann's, she had her own little local newspaper called Now, where she sort of, ran local advertising and stuff like that. She had her own organisation called the, Potts Point Ratepayers Association or something like that, But I don't want to sound like I'm putting it down. She was really active and a really good person, and she did really good stuff. But she kept away from us. The thing about Juanita is that when everything else had failed, and even after the Builders Labourers Green Ban was gone, there was still another Green Ban left, right? Which was that the Municipal Employees Union, the people who did all the sewerage stuff and things like that, they'd put a green ban on in sympathy to the BLs, and it wasn't removed when the BLs were removed, And Johnny Glebe, the guy who was the secretary, he and Juanita started hanging out. So Juanita, and it was known that Juanita was sort of the person who got that there and kept it there and whatever. Right. So she could be targeted. And because she was sort of naive, I really think she thought nothing could ever happen to her, And so she just went off to this meeting and they killed her.
Mm.
Simple as that, I mean, there's been endless speculation and stuff about exactly what happened after that. And, there's no great mystery about exactly who did it, but the exact motives and how it all happened has all been debated endlessly. But there's no doubt at all, that she was murdered, and that was why she was murdered, and whatever. There have been a few other suggestions that she also had other info on corruption and stuff like that, which is also perfectly possible, And I mean, she was really, I sound like I was being really horrible about it. I'm just trying to point out that she was a more complex person than everybody has sort of said about her, But she was really very brave, very brave and fought, right till the end, till the point where she was the last one left and she was still fighting and they killed her for it. It was that simple, And it's just appalling beyond belief. And like I say, I mean, I think, you know, we'd been more conscious of what we were up against, I think, from really early on. And I don't think she ever really wanted to completely admit that the world was that horrible, you know. And so she didn't quite admit it, and in the end it bit her. You know?
And so then if she was one of the final obstacles once she was gone...
The other Green Band came off as well. Right, because I just think Glebe couldn't sort of sustain it in the circumstances, you know. There's a lot of publicity around what happened to her and stuff like that, and he didn't have much support. And so that was, I remember going to a meeting with him about it, and it was just a pretty weird meeting. I think it sort of almost ended his career in the union movement as well.
Right. You know,
he just sort of forced out.
Yep.
Yeah, there was a lot of bad publicity around it in all sorts of ways, you know.
So when did that's when they started to redevelop, I guess.
Yeah. And, of course, the final redevelopment was the sort of compromise that no one wanted, right? It was a really dead ugly building. I mean, it maintained, some whole buildings got retained, a lot of facades got maintained. The actual building that was built but just couldn't have been more, well, let's say it set the tone for the next 20 years of Sydney large-scale redevelopment, you know. It was just plug ugly, you know, and drab and just a complete architectural embarrassment, you know, and it'll be there for another 100 years probably, you know. I mean, it's just a really awful building, you know. And it just, and yet there are people who walk there and sort of, because there's so many of the facades still on the street, they sort of think, well, nothing's happened, it's still beautiful Victoria Street. And then you sort of look up and they're, oh, hang on, there's this other great thing just up over your sight line, you know, behind it. And suddenly there's this huge 20-story monstrosity.
This may have been in the time when you were away, but people infiltrated one of Tiemann's party.
This was actually while we were still squatting.
Oh, okay. Tiemann was
operating on all fronts. He really, really wanted social acceptance. You know, he'd made his money in the rag trade. He was now trying to move up a whole peg altogether. And things like he was giving money to the opera and to things like that. And he did a... we found out that he was doing a fundraising thing for the opera. This is while we were squatting. This went on. Now, he'd bought this huge great house in this very ritzy little street in at the bottom of Bellevue Hill. And in fact, a very good friend of mine, who also happened to be very wealthy, actually lived right behind him. And she got an invitation to this opera fundraising thing. And she told me about it, and I went, oh, can we do something? And she went, yeah. She went and bought a whole table for us, right, you know, in her name, right? And so we all dressed up in tuxes and tails and, you know, like did the whole thing, you know. And there was enough of an age range of us to just pass, you know. Like we all knew, you know, we could pass in society if we dressed up, at least to get through the door, you know. And so we all got... work I just haven't done. And once we were in there, we just proceeded to slowly destroy the whole thing, you know, because we didn't just leave little things lying around and stuff like that. I actually had this sort of strange little rig up built into my dress suit. There's this stuff called butyric acid, which basically smells like vomit. You know, it's really repulsive when you get it. And I just went right through the house and put little bits of butyric acid all the way through the entire house. So the whole house, within about half an hour, you could barely go into his house with the smell, you know. And meanwhile, there was this huge demonstration going on outside. And but we were actually, there's about 10, 12 of us who were actually,
because there were cards there as well. Yeah,
we left little cards around the place and... and slowly they worked out who we all were and tracked us all down. And you know, the point that I got taken out the back gate, I thought, oh, this is it, I'm going to get a beating. But they didn't, you know. In fact, they dumped me into the back garden of the friend that had bought the things for me.
Just to wrap up, I suppose, I don't know if there's anything else you want to mention or whether you want to sort of, I suppose, talk about the significance of the campaign and sort of longer.
I think in lots of ways the significance of the campaign is that it was a good training ground for a lot of people who went on to do a whole lot of other things as well. You know, I'm sure everyone's aware of you know the significance of Green Bands and the builders' labourers and the effect they had. I mean, out of all of this stuff in the late 70s in New South Wales, we got heritage legislation, which actually we got consultative processes, which we'd never had. We got a whole range of things like that happened, yeah? Especially when Neville Wran was Premier. It was interesting because I was talking about I was on this committee early on with the BLs. Well, one of the other people on the committee with me was Neville Wran, you know, who at that stage was still just a QC. And Neville Wran had been really interested in this stuff and really involved as well. And so when he became Premier, you know, about 5 or 6 years later, he enacted the first heritage legislation. So basically the whole ball game changed after that. Of course, none of those things, strangely enough, you know, 30 years later, Labor government's removed most of that heritage legislation. But long before they removed it, developers and government likewise had worked out how to rot it anyway, you know, and consultative processes, which sounded fabulous to start with, became completely ritualised and really nothing, no real consultation happened at all. Even though everybody went to consultative meetings, nothing happened, nothing ever changed. They just tell you what they were going to do and then say you'd been consulted, you know. So you know, everything has unintended consequences and whatever. But nonetheless, I mean, at first, a lot of stuff changed and it was actually a great leap forward. Most of the inner city of Sydney would now be high rise, you know, if it hadn't been for that. And it's not. So, you know, the Rocks are still there, you know, Woolloomooloo is still there, Woolloomooloo is public housing right in the centre of Sydney. So, you know, there are a lot of obvious discernible things like that. They're battles that will now have to be won again probably at some point because they're slowly being lost again, you know, but it took them 30 or 40 years to get to the point where they could start to beat us back again. So, you know, nothing's won for forever. You have to keep winning it again and again and again. Lots of people who went there went on to do other things. Like I say, all the anti-corruption stuff that went on in New South Wales during the 70s really came out, originated in Victoria. Then lots of other people got recruited into it as a snowball, but its very core is there in work done in Victoria Street. So there's a whole lot of things came out of it, of one sort or another. Other squats popped up all over the place. Glebe, Piermont, those ones, and they went on for a decade or more, longer. There was even another later one in Victoria Street, you know, up the other end there, just around one or two buildings, but it was quite big at the time. That's in about 1977. So a lot of things came up and followed up from it, and a lot of people became radicalised or set off on paths that had a lot of political and cultural influence over time.
My name's Ian McIntyre and you've been listening to an interview with Ian Millis about the Victoria Street squats, which occurred in Sydney during the early 1970s. If you're interested in learning more about the rich history of Australian squatting, then visit the website www.australianmuseumofsquatting.com.